Women Who Rock.
This is Women Who Rock, a podcast promoting Australian female musicians and artists, and I'm very happy to say that I am joined by Sally from Sydney jazz punk band Finger May. Sally also does sound at a venue in Newtown, which is frequented pretty heavily by me. Sally, thanks so much for coming on to Women Who Rock.
Thanks for having me.
Jazz punk is a really interesting mashing of genres, but I think it's a pretty apt description for Finger May. I was interested, you use some pretty complex voicings of chords. Have you been playing jazz for a long time?
I can't play jazz. I've always wanted to play jazz, but I don't really have that sort of commitment. I have more of a punk attention span.
Okay.
I took a lesson from a teacher a long time ago that you can pretty much just play whatever you like, and if it sounds good, that's jazz.
Okay.
That's kind of my approach.
So you didn't go into it saying, I want to be a jazz musician?
I'd love to be able to play like James Muller or, you know, the endless modal solos and things.
Yeah.
But I'm probably not going to sit down and practice for 6 hours a day.
Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, it's a really complex way to start with. Yeah. Love and jazz. I saw you do a solo set with Finger May at Chicks with Picks, yeah. And you started off by saying, hi, I'm Finger May. If you have any requests, keep them to yourself. Now, my point is, your banter game is really strong. What kind of comedy are you into?
A lot. I don't know specifically what. I used to listen to a lot of stand-up, and I had a go at stand-up briefly. I sort of bombed out.
Oh, really?
Badly. It's something that I wanted to pursue, but I figured I'd probably have to do a lot of coke to make it work.
So how long ago did you... Have you only done it once, or have you done it multiple times?
I did Raw Comedy 2011, I think it was.
Okay.
It was probably 2011, 2012. I came runner-up. I think I might have got penalised for making fun of one of the other contestants.
Okay. Because I've always kind of thought that I'd love to do it just once. And a lot of people say that getting up and doing it, it's like one of the bravest things to do. Just like just before you went up and did the first time, is it excruciating? Is it super hard?
No, but you've got to be in the right mood. And okay. hence the probably, I think a lot of people do use a lot of stimulants. But I can't imagine doing it when you're not feeling bouncy and fast.
Okay. So it's not necessarily cathartic all the time?
No. I don't know. It was fun. It was also weird. Like, I found comedians to be super bitchy.
Okay. It's a little bit of a different world to musicians, or...
Yeah, it's not like you go and play a gig and everyone's like, oh, yeah, dig your stuff, man. It's like you go there and they're like, did you fucking steal my joke?
Wow. More of like a competitive...
There was this really weird gig at I can't remember the name. It's a bar on George Street. It might be defunct by now. But there was an open mic there. It was the week where Rudd deposed Gillard, and like three of the comedians had written a song about it, and two of them had even parodied the same song.
Oh, really?
And really thought they were going to go each other. It was just so tense.
Oh,
and
wow. Okay.
I was the only one there that wasn't making jokes about Gillard. So I was still doing music, like I was still doing musical comedy, like I was playing songs and introducing them and telling stories and things.
Okay. So did you have like a tight 5-minute routine? Is that how you went into it?
Yeah, it was pretty much just a 2 to 3 minute song and a few jokes around it. I've never done the comedy on its own thing. I think it was a way to trick myself into thinking it wasn't public speaking by holding a guitar.
Okay. So it was more kind of musical performance comedy.
Yeah. It was always a hybrid sort of thing.
But okay.
I find performing in musical settings it's just a bit easier and more fun. It's definitely easier to get into.
Yeah.
Comedy was fun. Like a few of the gigs were, I did like 6, I think. Like probably half of them were really fun and half of them were left me wondering what I was doing with my life.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, being on stage can do that. Yeah. I have a book that has transcripts from Bob Dylan interviews, and I'm going to paraphrase it. He said something like, in the early 1960s, when there was a new band, the question wasn't, what does this sound like? What are the songs like? But what are they trying to say? What is the message? Do you think that Finger May has an overarching message? Because I think it's more, it's somewhat politically driven.
If the message is, I hate you all, leave me alone, you might be onto something there.
Okay. So you don't sit down and think, we are trying to project this thought onto the world.
At this point, I'm writing all the songs. We're open to other two songs from Jackie and Lauren, but they're not really seeming to want to yet. We haven't discussed that. Maybe we should cut that out. I don't think that there's a unifying driving theme for the band. It's more stuff that I want to rant about. I do tend to be pretty politically engaged, and I do find that my favourite way to air frustrations is to bash a guitar and yell. Preferably in a way that's funny so I can get away with it and do it again.
Yeah. Well, I think that that is a great segue. I actually didn't know that you had done that musical comedy before. But what I'd like to do is to take and have a listen to one of your, I think, most recent single. It's called Not Racist But. I was listening to it again today, and there's some lines in there that I thought that really got me. They're pretty good. Let's have a listen to it, and then maybe we'll come back and have a bit of a chat about how that song came to be. So let's hear now. This is Finger May with Not Racist But.
Granddad fought in World War One to save the lucky country. He said he'd gladly do it all again. If our freedoms ever came to be curtailed, it was his duty to stand up and stand for our great southern land. Granddad's gone and things are not that simple anymore. I try to soldier on, but it's an unpopular cause. My country's all been lost, and though I'm trying to reclaim it, every day I feel attacked for being such a proud Australian. It's gotten so bad I can't make a colour joke at work. Nobody laughs and I get sent to HR. Can't start shit on the train with any women wearing burqas. Without people filming me or calling for the guards. You can't say healthy words that we grew up with anymore. Can't boo at footy players or call anyone a name. Blackface is off limits and hairdressers out of style. But they'll never take my dreadlocks and the ditch comes to my grave. It's getting harder for a battler to stand up for what's true blue. But that's some training with PC, can't telling you what to do. Granddad wouldn't recognise his new rules of engagement. Every day I feel attacked for being such a proud Australian. I order coffee white with sugar, always ask for no halal. But I can taste it in there almost half the time. I don't push police or force my culture onto anyone, but they can put that shit into my virgin mind. On our national day we should all come together to rejoice. But I can't enjoy my land without reminders that my ancestors had questionable tactics moving in. So screw the jobs well done and try not to think of bloodshed. We stopped first but other princes managed to survive us. Our country's been invaded by those uptight liberal whiners. When I wear the flag that people brand me as a racist, every day I feel attacked for being such a proud Australian. I'm sick of trying to read signs cluttered up with dual language, and then a guffle of them building temples that I don't have to frequent. No less spicy food can fuck off back to where it came from. So long and thank you for the butter chicken. There's people learning English as a second language, not the first. And in my mind that shit amounts to treason. We have to put our foot down, or before you know we'll speak Chinese and I'll cancel footy season. It seems like everywhere I turn there's people living their own lives in ways and in appearances that don't resemble mine. All this diversity is confronting, I don't think that I can take it. Every day I feel attacked for being such a proud Australian. It feels like I am trapped in a toy raft with ineffective oars, struggling to push against the gentle waves that threaten to upend my world. There's children standing in the wayside water laughing at my life jacket, but I'm not afraid to know when I'm out of my depth. I look towards the Southern Cross to find my way back to Australia. I'm on an express route skipping AUL and I feel the why. Just a flag for cover, I'm slowly turning crimson. I guess the symbols really don't protect you in the end. Seems like everywhere I turn there's people living their own lives. It weighs in their appearances, a term is in my mind. All this diversity has been funny, I don't think that I can take it. Every day I feel attacked for being such a bad Australian.
That is Finger May with Not Racist, But. I really like the line, it feels like I'm trapped in a toy raft with ineffective oars. I'm privy to the story behind that song. Can you tell us about the event that you saw that led to you writing that song?
Yeah, I've been at Gordon's Bay one day with a few friends, and it was just towards the end of the day, and we were getting ready to leave, and we saw two men dressed head to toe in the Australian flag, Australian flag towels on the beach, even Australian flag thongs. One guy was filming the other guy in an Australian flag decorated inflatable, and he was just sort of ineffectually rowing out to sea, but like not going anywhere. Didn't talk to them or anything. They sort of said hi, and we, you know, being a group of lesbians, glared at them. Someone from our group said that they thought one of the guys was Nick Folks, and that sort of adds up because that's the sort of thing he would do. And I never figured out. I never tried to find the video or anything, but I just made an assumption that he was trying to make some sort of metaphor of rowing against the tide.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I don't know. It could even be that song could. I might have just committed defamation. I don't know. But that was the inspiration for it.
Okay. He was trying to row out to sea, but was it a media thing? Were there people there, like, filming what he was doing?
No,
or not
it was,
really?
There was one guy filming and one guy in the boat, but, like, he was trying to make it look like he couldn't row against the tide, but the surf was really gentle.
Okay.
So it was, like, sort of just barely dipping the rows in the oars in the water.
Okay. Thwarted by nature.
Yeah.
Yet again.
It's quite a lot of effort to go to find all that Australiana merchandise, I'm sure.
Yeah. I read the John Safran book, depends what you mean by extremist, and the thing that I got from that movement, the United Patriots Front, is that it seems as though there was so much noise and so much media attention over such a relatively lo-fi organisation.
Yeah, it's...
I guess it was kind of centred more on Melbourne. It was more things happened in Melbourne, I can see that, what happened in Sydney, but...
Yeah, I'm a little bit out of date because I haven't actually brushed up on my local racist organisations.
Okay.
But I think they just hit a nerve because it's just so ridiculously stupid and offensive, but it really angers people to see it being taken seriously, I think.
From the lyricism, I'd like to move a little bit to the more technical side. One day at the townie, we were having a chat about splitting a signal to a guitar amp and a bass amp, and you told me that making that pedal is not that difficult. Do you make your own pedals?
I've made one. I made a loop pedal, as in it would divert the signal. It would have a pass-through channel, and it would also have... You could switch it to either divert it like a railway track, like it would take it off one channel and onto the other, or you could send it to both, like split it.
Okay.
Still got it somewhere. It's a very ugly pedal because I'm not really into the silk, what do you call it, the screen painting stuff.
So do you did you learn that by yourself, or did you study some kind of music electronics?
I Googled that one.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I've done, I mostly Google things. Just as an aside, Remy Phillips makes pedals. He's very... I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, I've seen him at the townie.
Yeah.
A lot of the good things that I've learned about life, I learned at the townie.
I just gave him a bunch of old pedals that I was saving to try to learn more about, but have just not got time for. Anyway, so if you see some horrible noises popping up, that's... I might have contributed to that.
The first time I saw Remy play... He did this, like, 20-minute thing where he was on stage and playing and, like, changing all the switches and dials on all his pedals. So he's like a gear man, I guess.
We get reviews from management sometimes, and one that stuck with me from Remy was from one of the managers said it was just three words, sounds like pain.
So. Sounds like pain. It's good to get it out on stage than anywhere else, I guess.
Yeah.
Which also, I mean, one of the things that I find really fascinating is that you're very active musician, but you also do sound. So I'd kind of like to delve into that a little bit. I'm just wondering if we experience being on stage in a different way. Is it harder when you're on stage to kind of get lost in the moment if you're also thinking about, you know, what's happening with the mids or where are the vocals in the mix?
Only if it's my venue where I'm sort of in control of it a little bit.
Okay.
So like only really when I'm playing at the Townie, because I'll generally have an iPad mixer nearby and the temptation to fuck with things is a bit is a bit hard to ignore, and the band know they can say, they can talk to me for the, you know, if they want more whatever in the monitors, yeah, rather than talking to the front of house, and it is a bit hard to get into a good headspace playing there when I'm involved in it. But anywhere else, it's not that hard. You just have to sort of, like, you just have to trust whoever's mixing you and let go of it.
Okay.
I'd say it is easier for me to talk to mixers though, because I know the language.
Yeah. But, yeah. Okay.
And how to not anger them, and
yeah, you know all the tricks.
Yeah.
Does that flow into recordings as well, because you have such a sort of strong technical background? Does it make being in the studio a kind of different thing as well, where you're more hands-on to what's going on?
I'm not sure if it does really. Like at the moment, I've gone full DIY. That one we just played was, I recorded every part of that. But the album before that, I actually made a point of trying not to be in control of it,
because okay,
I wanted some outside input. I work with somebody I respect a great deal, Brian Compo, and came out with a really different sort of thing than I would have done on my own. Like I would have done something more along the punk rock sort of lines. But you know, it ended up with much more of a weird pop sort of thing with Brian, and then we argued about it at the end, and that was probably something I should have seen coming. But
Yeah, I guess if some of that creative control is wrested away, it's hard to let it all go, but it is good to get that extra set of ears.
No, I think that was... I stand by that choice. I'm happy to have done it. I learned a lot, too. I'd really disagree with how high Brian likes the vocals, but other than that, I really, really enjoyed it, and I'm really grateful to have had that chance.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because... Is it the thing with comparison between rock and pop? The vocals are more buried in a rock track compared to a pop track?
So I guess it depends on the style of the rock. Like grunge, I think they sit a little bit lower because they're not that important. It's more important about how loud your flannelette is.
Kind of studio experience to doing it DIY, does that come with its own kind of set of frustrations as well?
I enjoy the DIY thing. Like Brian's studio was still a small studio. It's just him there. It's not a team of minions or anything. DIY at home, the main frustration is aircraft noise and housemates. But,
okay.
But I've actually just moved to my own place, and it has double glazed windows, and that's amazing.
Nice.
And so I'm looking forward to getting into a bit more of that now. But
so did you do drums in a DIY setting?
That song we just played, we recorded the drums at Lauren's house. Lauren is the drummer. It took 4 hours to set everything up, and then 1.5 hours to troubleshoot why my rig kept crashing. Which the answer to that was because it was a 2013 MacBook and it doesn't like running a 16-channel interface.
Okay. And that after an hour and a half, you figured that out?
After an hour and a half, we figured out that... I don't know why it was crashing, other than maybe it was just not enough processing power, but I figured out that the way to get it going was basically to restart the computer every time the screen froze. So we'd do, like, one or two takes. It would freeze, reboot, which takes, like... 10 minutes or whatever. Take a break. Get back into it. And
that's a very IT crowd solution to that problem.
Yeah, it was definitely a turn it on off again solution. But it worked. We did drums for about 3 or 4 songs, I think. So we've got more to come out of that session.
Okay. Yeah. So what I'm interested also in the mixing and mastering, do you get involved? Because we were talking about Pro Tools off air just before. Are you heavily involved with the mixing and mastering? Do you take that on?
Well, I mixed that one. Like, I did everything except mastering on that one. The only one I've mastered for release for myself is the song before that, Topsy Turvy, which was just a cajon, a guitar and vocal. So it was pretty easy. Mastering is kind of... I don't like using cliches, but I think it really is kind of a dark art. I spent quite a lot of time trying to learn it and made a lot of progress, and I'm still hopeless.
Okay. There's just so much to learn.
Yeah.
That's why I've kind of been, every time we've been in the studio, I've let someone else. I haven't had the time to deal with that frustration. But I'm also still, I have a bit of an understanding about the difference. Could you give a concise, you've had a go at both, could you give a concise description about the difference between the mixing and the mastering process?
Yeah. Mixing is putting the pieces together, and mastering might be sort of sanding it down and lacquering it.
Okay.
I guess.
That's actually, I think, a pretty good analogy. So it's kind of the finishing touches.
Yeah, like it's, like your mix hopefully sounds good on its own, but then mastering, you shave out little bits of redundant sounds, like makes it really sort of makes the beat thump more, and makes the vocals just that bit clearer in area, makes the whole thing sort of sparkle. It's really hard to get your head around, but it's like, because you might treat the, I've been trying to learn mid-side mastering recently. I did that with Topsy Turvy, but it's so hard with a band, because it's like it's just like taking it from 3D to 7D or whatever.
Oh wow, okay. You have such an interesting insight, because you've kind of had a go at all the things: being on stage, being behind the stage with the iPad, doing the recordings, doing the mixing and mastering. How long have you been doing sound?
About 6 years.
6 years.
Just on mastering, I was going to say...
Sure.
I was going to say I got a lot of help from William Dundon when I asked him. He's very nice.
Okay.
Gave.
Good to have mentors when you're stepping into the void.
I didn't ask him how to master, but he gave me a lot of help with mixing and gave feedback and stuff.
Have been doing sound for like 6 years. I'm interested to get your insight into changes in technology. Because I know now that you buzz around with an iPad, and are you like dynamically controlling?
The iPad's more like a MIDI controller for the mixer. Like, it doesn't process any audio. It's just a remote control to the engine at back of the desk.
Okay.
You can do the entire thing on there. Before I got the Q24 at work, I had the Q-Pad, which is the same engine. This is the branded mixer, the Allen & Heath Q24 Q-Pad. Versus QPad. QPad is the app. QPack is the mixer. I did do it on an iPad only for about 6 months, maybe 9 months, and that was a really bad idea because I got a cubital tunnel and carpal tunnel.
Ooh.
Just from the sort of holding an object in one position all night and using very fine motor control all night. I wasn't using a stylus either, which is... The physiotherapist told me I was an idiot for that.
Okay.
But
They probably have styluses, don't they? I don't have an iPad, so...
Yeah, you can get a stylus for it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Very easy to lose, I assume.
Yeah, I had to buy them in bulk, but...
Yeah.
But, holding onto an iPad for, like, the shortest gigs are usually around 3 hours, but some of them are more like 6 to 7. That was very bad, and I've just got to do like stretches every day now to stave that off.
Oh, but, really?
Because the physio. Because once you've got cubital tunnel and carpal tunnel, like the nerves are sort of just ready to flare up still.
Oh.
I was getting electric shocks in my arms and things.
Wow.
But
that's a tough job.
it's also getting old. It's everything starts to break.
Yeah. So the iPad is not giving you. The feedback that you're getting is from your ears, and you're using the iPad as control. It's not telling you about what's happening at the low frequencies, or is it? I don't really know what you're doing.
I think it. I don't think it has a meter in it. I think it, what some of the brands have a RTAS meter, which I don't even know what that stands for, but that's the one that gives you the graph of the frequencies.
Okay.
But no, it's just ears. It's literally like just carrying the mixer around with you. It's because it just has all the controls on there. Obviously, the mixer's a lot faster too because it's a tactile surface and you can grab a few faders at once. Like the iPad's one control at a time because it's not a multi-gesture surface.
So is that the main technological advancement over the last 6 years when you're doing sound in a live venue? Having that control?
The iPad's is a major thing, like being able to line check people from the stage and talk to them there, and you know, actually it helps you make things happen a lot faster because you're not, you know, 10 meters away talking to them over a microphone and they're getting distracted by everything and it's just so much easier when you can hear what they're hearing on the monitors. And but I'd say in the last 6 years or whatever, the digital mixers have just sort of become quite standard. Like when I started, there were still like the lower end venues all still mostly had crappy old analog things, and like I used to carry a compressor and a reverb unit around because some of the places I'd go wouldn't have any of that. And it's just like everyone's either got a Behringer X32 or a Q24 or something now.
Cool.
Or the cheapest one around is the Soundcraft one, I think.
Well, Sally, thank you so much for coming on. I think you've given us a really interesting insight into all the facets. I've been really looking forward to this chat, and I appreciate having you on Women Who Rock.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You can't help that you are from the past. She can't hurry. Make it up to the people you put in last. Well, it's a South to serve their world, trying to keep up so harder than you like to admit. But if your way of life is threatened by equality.
Women Who Rock is proudly produced in the Sydney studios of 2SER 107.3.